Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, and welcome to Everything is Fine, a podcast for women over 40. I'm Talia Bacassus.
And I'm Kim France.
Today's guest is Andy Zeisler, author of the fantastic book, We Were Feminists Once, From Riot Girl to Cover Girl, The Buying and Selling of a Political Movement. She's contributed to Mother Jones, The New York Times, The Washington Post, Ms., and other publications. And she's also the co-founder of Bitch Media, which includes the fabulous Bitch magazine, a scrappy feminist publication that has managed to survive and thrive in an era when magazines are struggling to even exist. I only discovered Bitch fairly recently, and I feel like they've got all these really great lists also of like 15 feminist books you should be reading right now, feminist movies you should be watching right now. And it feels like feminism as a concept almost is under attack in this day and age, and it is a very relevant thing to be talking about and re-examining and reasserting about ourselves. So hi, Andy.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about how Bitch came to be?
Yeah, Bitch came to be when one of my high school friends, this was 1995, both of us had interned at Sassy at different times. So I was there, and around the time that we started talking about doing Bitch was when Sassy was bought by the publishing company that published like Guns and Ammo and like Teen Magazine. And it became what we called like bizarro zombie Sassy. Like it was really trying to, it was trying to capture that voice, but it just failing miserably. And at the time that I was interning at Sassy, Ms. Magazine was a few floors up. And I remember I was always being sent up there to get old issues for reference. And that was really when I started reading Ms., because my mother was not, she was much more a Vogue person than a Ms. person. And so Lisa and I started, we were huge fans of pop culture, but we also spent a ton of time just talking about how ill-served women and particularly young women were by pop culture representations and as creators of popular culture. So yeah, we started talking about how great it would be and how much we would have wanted like a magazine that really blended Sassy and Ms., because Sassy did a lot of, you know, explicitly feminist stuff, like using the word feminist. But at the time we started Bitch, Ms. had they seemed to have moved on to thinking pop culture was sort of silly. And that's not to say that it wasn't a great magazine in 1995, but it did feel a little bit more like homework. And so the idea was like, what if we had an actual magazine that sort of, that identified pop culture as kind of a locus of feminist analysis? And that was the start of it. We really were sort of thinking big. We started as a zine, but we always had the kind of like pipe dream of, well, maybe one day will be a real magazine. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the start of it. I mean, it grew pretty organically. But if you define zines as something that's done for love and not money, I think in many ways Bitch has remained a zine. Mm-hmm. in both sort of financial and, you know, the spirit of it. You know, it's never been something that we saw as a mainstream magazine.
Mm-hmm. And why did you call it Bitch?
yeah, that's a good question. I think, so Lisa and I both grew up in New York City, and we were just very used to hearing that word in the most sort of quotidian of places, you know, like walking down the street, if you got catcalled and you didn't smile or you didn't acknowledge who was catcalling you, you know, they'd call you a bitch or they'd shout it after you. And through our high school and college years, we had also witnessed the way that young women spoke up in ways that were interpreted as hostile to men, or the idea that basically women who wanted to make a point or have their voices heard or counter something that a man was saying, bitch was kind of the go-to. You know, there are so many like non-gendered insults that you can use. Mm-hmm. But the idea that when the subject is a woman, it's always like zero straight to bitch. Right. We really felt that that was a kind of universal experience.
It's like reclaiming a word the way that they've done with other words.
Right. We had watched the way like queer had been reclaimed by the LGBT community, the sort of in your face reclamation. It felt really powerful. Mm-hmm. And because bitch was not in common parlance at that time the way it is now, it really did feel more potent to call a feminist magazine bitch, almost as if we were, you know, saying, well, we expect just by doing this project that we will be called bitches, so let's
we're
just go ahead
and
let's like not let you have that satisfaction, let's do it first.
We call ourselves that, so don't worry about it.
Do you think millennials are interested in feminism at all? I'm always amazed that they don't even seem to care that their reproductive rights are being stripped away even as we speak.
Are you talking about millennials or are you talking about Gen Z?
Wait a minute.
Millennials are like pushing 40 at this point. Like,
right.
But also millennials, the millennials that I know are very engaged. My sister-in-law, actually, sorry, is she Gen Z? If somebody in their 20s, are they millennials or Gen Z?
I think they're Gen Z.
Oh, well, she's Gen Z and she's incredibly engaged. She's one person, but I mean,
I just wonder where the voices are around the women governing their own bodies. And I feel like it's all coming from women my age.
I mean, I definitely think it's there, but they are, you know, from my perspective, and I, you know, I work with a couple of Gen Z people and I certainly edit a lot of them. They are coming from a much more intersectional place that isn't, it's not single issue. It's kind of the acknowledgement that talking about access to abortion is also a conversation about poverty and environmental racism and the absolute rigged game of capitalism. So I think it's a little more diffuse maybe than the sort of pro-choice activism that we grew up with, where, you know, it was very specifically about that access. Something that I find interesting in terms of the way that a lot of Gen Z and certainly millennial people talk about these issues is that they see it through very personal lenses, which is, I think, the way a lot of older generations also saw it, but did not feel really empowered to speak out from that lens. I feel like I sound like such an old person saying the young people. When the youth, when
I
they
feel
write
like an
about...
old person when you said millennials are pushing 40, I was like, what?
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess to answer your question, Kim, they're certainly engaged. It's just, it looks different. It's a different sort of matrix.
Right.
And maybe they're on places that we don't see.
True.
Like they're on Snapchat,
oh yeah, they're
wherever.
On TikTok for sure.
Oh yeah, see, I didn't even like Snapchat.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, TikTok. See, look at me.
I know.
I was like, That's Generation X, like, old brain.
I know. That's like what my mom would say. Tic-tac. Mm.
Yeah. That is where I think a lot of sort of Gen Z people are sort of congregating, finding community and finding their sort of, you know, their gateway to feminism, the way like Spin Magazine and Sassy were my gateways to feminism.
Right. And when you think about what they did to that Trump rally on TikTok, it is kind of amazing.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
True.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not giving them enough credit. I guess I'm not. You've said, Andy, that even though you feel lucky that Bitch is still around, you're sad it still has to be around. Can you explain that?
Well, you know, I think it's a magazine that has always been about making the case that popular culture and media are really important places, really important sites of feminist inquiry. You know, as a mission-driven publication, that was about, you know, sort of making feminism more accessible to a greater number of people. You know, we wanted to put ourselves out of business. We wanted to get to a place where feminism was part of the landscape in enough ways that people did not feel starved for content. I think we've gotten to that place, but it certainly hasn't, you know, it certainly doesn't look like what we hoped it might look like. And I think that speaks a lot to our naivete and sort of youthful hubris. Like, we weren't thinking like, oh, feminism is going to become trendy and be, you know, co-opted by the forces of capitalism. We were thinking more like everyone will start, you know, seeing things through a feminist lens. And I think the latter part of that in many ways has happened. Like, there are so many places where you see feminist lenses being applied to, you know, movies or television in a way that they never would have been in the 90s. It's sort of a feeling of wanting to be obsolete, but also wanting to have made a difference. And I think in terms of feminism and its kind of trendiness and popularity, we have certainly been a part of making that happen, but that's not necessarily the thing that we would want to claim, you know?
Right.
It's like any kind of activism, I guess, where you would like the thing that you are protesting or speaking out against didn't exist and you wish you didn't have to do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you talk about what you refer to in your book as empowertizing?
Empowertizing is basically the strain of advertising that, rather than using shame to sell products to women, it uses this sort of vague notion of empowerment, which in the past couple of decades has become kind of this Mad Lib word that people will sort of pop in. And again, much like feminism itself, it's become this word that, you know, media outlets will sort of pop in where it really doesn't belong, in a way that sort of reframes things. So, you know, like every Women's History Month, every year in March, there's, you know, sort of these ridiculous rebranding efforts that last for, you know, one day, like McDonald's one year, like flipping the M into a W for women, but like not doing anything about, you know, the class action sexual harassment suits. So it's sort of a way to sort of launder brands' public image without actually standing for any change and without actually walking the walk.
So like greenwashing, but for feminism.
Yes, definitely.
Once I read that you wrote that, I started to see it everywhere. There was a campaign just a few days ago. It was like 6 or 8 full page New York Times ads that were for Oil of Olay with like very empowering messages about being a scientist and, you know, being educated and being all these things. And it was for Oil of Olay.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I think the sort of first brand that really made hay of that was Dove with
Thank you.
Yeah. With their Real Bodies campaign. And, you know, that was probably like 15 years ago at this point. But do you remember what a huge deal that was when people were like, billboards with women who are size 12? Like, what is this sorcery? You know, like people really thought that was just absolutely the bravest, boldest move, and didn't really seem to, or didn't admit to, understanding that the product itself was like firming cream. You know?
But Kim, you said that you found that ad disingenuous, and I don't know. I also feel like the flip side of that is that it's showing different women's bodies on big billboards, and that does have an upside.
It does have an upside, but in the end, it's all to sell shit. It's just all to sell shit. And in the minute it stopped working, they moved on to something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they managed to keep it running for a while because they were literally creating products based on problems that, you know, women did not actually realize they had until Dove pointed it out. Like the whole one with like turn armpits into underarms. Like that is a part of my body that I had really never thought to be concerned with, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, so you've created this idea that women's underarms are not, you know, smooth enough or sexy enough, and you just happen to have this new deodorant that's going to, you know, help that. That's wildly disingenuous.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I think despite the fact that they did very, you know, canny ads that were meant to go viral and did go viral, they were able to sort of use that, again, to sort of cover up what they were actually doing.
I always want to be a fly on the wall in those meetings where somebody's like, what about armpits? You know, nobody seems very upset about those.
Right.
Relatedly, you've said that feminism can never truly be glamorous or fun. So why is that? And why do you think certain women need a side order of glamour with their feminism?
Well, I mean, to be clear, I think feminism can be glamorous. It certainly can be made glamorous. There have always been avatars of feminism or figureheads who have been glamorous. But the concept itself is never going to be glamorous because it really is about making a case for very unsexy things. You know, it's not about leaning in and claiming the corner office. It's about women who are stuck in minimum wage jobs in states that are making it increasingly hard for them to get access to like birth control, but which are also, you know, trying to outlaw abortion. Like, it's a lot of stuff that I think it's very inconvenient for a lot of people, particularly those in power, to reckon with, that there's a ton of inequality and very few people who are actively trying to fix it. And I, you know, it's just, it's not fun. And I think one of the things about feminism over the years is that there's really been this effort to make it palatable to an audience of people who aren't feminists in the hope that they'll come around and be like, oh, well, now I see that, you know, feminism is actually necessary now that I've, you know, seen it in an energy drink. But, you know, let's be real. Those people were never going to care anyway, you know? So it's just sort of a vicious cycle.
Well, what do you say to women who won't define themselves as feminists? Like, there are some people who are allergic to the word. I've never really understood that.
I've certainly been honing those responses for most of my life. And, you know, I think there are definitely ways to point out the way that what they believe is compatible with feminism, and that the opportunities they have and the opportunities they want to have been really made possible by feminism. But, you know, I think in a lot of ways in the past half decade or so, it's been flipped a little bit in the sense that feminism has become a label that people want to claim because it is sort of not, you know, not glamorous, but it's a label that has a kind of cultural cachet in some ways that may not be specifically about activism, but about sort of the trappings of feminism, like an aesthetic of feminism.
Did you watch Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation hearing?
I actually didn't watch them. I kept sort of turning on live streams and then just immediately having to pop out because it was raising my blood pressure. It was so frustrating to know that this is happening and that this is all theater, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, my impression of her is that, you know, every time she was being questioned, she sort of looked like a tiny bomb had just gone off in her head. Like she had this very like wide-eyed, surprised look and, you know, was refusing to answer questions.
Yeah, I dipped in and out of it also. I couldn't really handle it.
Well, you're so lucky to live in Canada. Oh my gosh.
No kidding.
Does everyone want to marry you?
Andy, that was the funniest tweet anybody has ever tweeted the other week when you tweeted, "Will somebody from a boring country please marry me?"
Oh my God. You know? I didn't mention that, you know, it would have to be a throuple and that I would actually have to talk my partner into it. But really, I mean, who hasn't been having those thoughts? I mean, you know, of course I'm going to stay and I'm going to fight, but would I turn it down if someone was like, hey, you know, come to New Zealand for a year and live in my farmhouse and I don't know.
I know, like, it's very appealing.
I'm not going to turn it down. Like, I just want to be somewhere where I do not have to think, like where I don't have to kind of have 59 seconds out of every minute of my life occupied in some way by the anger and the fear and the anxiety of this country and this administration. Like, I feel like I would have so much of my brain back. And that would, you know, that would be great.
Can you describe what you call marketplace feminism and also tell us what the problem is with marketplace feminism?
Yeah, I mean, I think I touched on this a little bit with empowertizing. But I mean, marketplace feminism has always existed. It's a way to sort of leverage the values of feminism, the language of feminism, the imagery of feminism, to sell things to people, you know? I mean, it happened in the 1920s with cigarettes. It happened in the 1960s with, you know, perfume or sweaters. It happened in the 80s sort of undercover of the kind of greed is good, Jane Fonda workout.
But is there a problem with, like, let's say I am the kind of person who would buy a shirt that says, "Je suis féministe," or something like that. Like, if it was cool and it was nicely designed, like, I'm a sucker for that.
I don't think marketplace feminism as something that sort of people participate in is necessarily bad, but it is sort of what it represents. It is sort of about turning feminism into something you are or something you wear rather than something you do.
Right.
And certainly when you see like high fashion brands like Christian Dior, you know, advertise a plain white t-shirt that says whatever it said, feminism is the future, and charge $700 for it, you know, who is that for, you know?
Right.
Are you really trying to convince women who have that kind of money to spend on a t-shirt that feminism is valid? Because if they do have that kind of money and they're already not on board, it, you know, maybe they just don't care. So it really is sort of about feminism as a label.
All right. Why don't we take a break here for some ads, and we'll be back in a moment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back to Everything is Fine.
We've arrived at the portion of the show where we talk about Taylor Swift. Is it a good thing that celebrities like Taylor Swift and Beyonce seem to embrace feminism? And do you think the message is coming through with their audiences or to their audiences?
I mean, I think they're two very different examples of, you know, an embrace of feminism. And as someone who grew up in the 80s where celebrities would, you know, rather go out without makeup on than admit to being a feminist, it is actually kind of amazing to live in a time and see the way that celebrities are happy to embrace feminism. So just on an optical level, that's good, because if young people whose first exposure to feminism is Taylor Swift talking about it or Beyonce at the MTV Video Music Awards with the neon letters behind her, they're getting a positive first exposure as opposed to what a lot of us got, which was, you know, these are angry women who wear acid-washed vests and want to castrate men. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah. That was a little too on point.
Yeah, sorry about that. I have a couple of pairs of pants that I call my second wave pants, just because they seem very, like, they're sort of big. They're not really bell bottoms, but they're, you know, you could see them in the 70s.
What do you think the greatest enemy is to feminism right now in the U.S.?
Oh, my God. Well, I mean, that's the thing, is I don't think there's just one. But certainly, to be really frank, it's the same enemy that it's always been, which is, you know, white male fragility and inability to cede power or to, you know, see women with independence and ideas as anything more than a threat to what they believe to be the natural order. It's really interesting how reluctant mainstream corporate feminism has been to really say, like, you know what, we have to talk about the fact that these men are actually the problem. You know, women in many ways are still taught to internalize so much of their failures to do it all, or the fact that they have a difficult time balancing their career and their personal lives. But so much of that really is because things like the balance of domestic labor, for instance, like the actual chores done by men versus those done by women in heterosexual partnerships, those are still incredibly unequal. We still have a lot of proof that, you know, married heterosexual men say they want to marry a successful woman, but when that woman becomes successful in a way that makes them nervous or feel small, all of a sudden they don't want that.
Yep. You just described my marriage.
Yeah. I mean, I do think there's a way in which mainstream feminism has spent a lot of time trying to get men to embrace feminism without directly confronting the sort of material realities that allow men to keep women where they are, even inadvertently. I don't think it's like some grand plot all the time. I don't think there's like a bunch of men sitting in a boardroom. I mean, certainly there are a bunch of old white men sitting in rooms in the Capitol discussing, you know, how they can better, you know, confine women to the home barefoot and pregnant. But I think there are a lot of there are a lot of men out there who do think that they are feminist and are supporting women. And it doesn't mean that they're not. It just means that there's a lot of stuff that they don't see, and thus they don't realize that it's something that is on them to change, you know?
Well, it's been really disheartening in the pandemic to read all these studies and reports on how many women are leaving the workforce because they have to take care of their children and their schooling, and because kids are at home doing Zoom school and somebody has to supervise and be there, and that it's majority women. But I will say what is encouraging is how much I find at least it's being talked about. And that there is an awareness. And when you bring it up to people, it's not like their eyes glaze over and they don't know what you're talking about. I'm talking about men. Like, there is an awareness on some level. And I feel like that is some kind of progress.
I think that's true. And I think a lot of that does come out of social media and the way that social media has driven a lot of these conversations in ways that, for instance, articles in the New York Times Magazine never have.
Right.
Because on social media, it's people sharing, it's people talking about their own experiences and realizing that these are experiences that are shared, and these are experiences that they're inconvenient to discuss in a lot of the usual forums.
I'm like, I always want to...
I feel like this is so depressing. Like, I feel like I'm being such a huge bummer.
Well, that was what I was trying to say, was I'm looking for an uplifting way to end this, but it feels like these are bleak times. And so it's hard to find, like, what are the top things we should be doing, or what how should people be thinking about that? I don't know even how to reframe it as a positive end. There is no positive end.
I think that's the problem, is that we're in like a confluence of terrible things that are really magnifying existing inequalities that have always been there, and really making them unignorable. And unfortunately, these are real world things that are changing people's lives. So, you know, I'm happy to talk about like beauty products or something, because honestly, I think there's very few things that I can talk about these days without, you know, going to that sort of dark and hopeless place.
Well, if you want to share your favorite beauty product with us, Andy.
There is a certain part of our audience that really wants to hear what your number one beauty product is. And the others, this is the end of the show.
Yeah, I don't know if I actually have a favorite beauty product, but I feel like I've always had more interest in that kind of stuff than people might think. And no one ever asked me about it. And it's weird to talk about, you know what I mean? Because it's sort of like... It's not really a part of my daily life, but I don't like to perpetuate the idea that, you know, if you're a feminist, you don't care about how you look or things like that. You know, I've been struggling for like 2 years about whether I should start dyeing my hair.
I also wanted to say that I like the way that millennials, the ones who are nearing 40 even, have reframed this part of the conversation towards self-care, and how that is a little bit of something that you're doing for yourself to keep yourself sane and to work on your mental health. So it doesn't seem as frivolous.
Yeah, I definitely think that's true. And again, I really think that that's something that happens when people themselves start having these conversations and driving the subject matter rather than sort of being told what they should be caring about. Mm. You know, I think we all contain multitudes. I don't know why that continually surprises so many people.
Yeah.
All right. So lay it on us.
Oh, so I think Kim might have said this on a recent podcast, but I am also the person who puts on lipstick mindlessly and then goes out wearing a mask and then has like this giant smudge in the mask, but also across my face.
You guys are in good company. I read that Isabella Rossellini does that too.
I read too.
That does make me feel better. And that, like, that's what I love about her. Like, she will absolutely just have no problem saying that.
Yeah.
But I discovered these lip tints that are really good. And
oh, talk to me. I love lip tints.
Yeah. I don't even know how I found out about this website, but there's this website that, you know, is mostly like Korean beauty products, like K-beauty. And lip tints are apparently huge there. They still smudge a little, but nothing like lipstick. So I feel like
but those they also look really natural.
They do. I mean, as an incredibly, like an almost translucently pale person, I can't really wear super dark shades, but I love them. So lip tints, actually, they work. And I don't know. You know, I do think, I do think we all do need like a little spot of glamour sometimes,
yeah,
especially now.
I am totally Googling lip tints when we get off the phone.
Oh, good.
I just want to say, as a frightfully pale person, not that you said you're frightfully pale, but I think of myself as frightfully pale.
Oh, no, I am.
I just bought this thing recommended by a friend, Hylia, that is The Ordinary, and it's some kind of glow stuff, and it's, I don't know, a fermented something natural-ish product, and it's kind of like a bronzer, but it's not as ridiculous as a bronzer. It's a very subtle product that makes me feel a tiny bit less pale and has actually made me feel really nice.
Aww. Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
There, yeah. We ended on a
there we go. That's what we needed. Yeah,
the only way to do it. The only way to do it was not talk about current events.
Right now, that's all. That's what it's about. It's escapism, you know?
Yeah. So, Andy, where do you want people to find you after this?
I'm always on Twitter. I think that's where I'm sort of the most active, for better or worse. But, you know, I also encourage people to go to bitchmedia.org.
Andy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. This was really fun.
I don't feel depressed. I'm okay.
Oh, me too.
Good. I'll still worry about it, but.
Don't worry about it.
Really? All
right.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.